nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
So this is the fourth lecture on the radiation physics. And just to briefly remind you where things are, we are talking about effect of radiation on device performance. And in the first lecture, I just explained that there is a lot of devices fail because of if poorly designed for radiation hardness. That was the first lecture. I didn't really explain anything in that one. Simply said that in industry, lot of failures occur in devices due to radiation. In the second lecture, I explained to you that there are these four sources of radiation. What are those sources? One is cosmic ray. The second one was solar wind. The third one was packaging. And the fourth one was packaging, but induced by these neutrons which come and strike boron 10 and therefore generate lithium. And the lithium then generates generates electron hole pair. So the second lecture was primarily about counting how many protons actually strike your IC. And that, of course, depend on the height. If you are at different heights in the atmosphere, then, of course, the flux will be different. In the last lecture, we said, okay, given this flux, then a fraction of them are alpha particles, a fraction of them are protons. How many, given an energy of those things, how many electron hole pairs will be generated as a result? That's what we are saying. And then we also said that neutrons don't generate anything. It's a charge neutral. The only way things can be generated is if there's a nuclear reaction. So it hits a silicon atom, the silicon atom breaks apart, the protons come about, the alpha particles come about, and then they generate as a secondary particle these charges. So now I want to continue and give you one example about how it affects devices. So again, the physics, you can see how the pieces are built up on top of each other. So I'll tell a story about a type of dynamic random access memory, which is DRAM for short. One class of dynamic random access memory is called zero capacitor random access memory. I'll explain what that is in a second, or ZRAM for short. And then I'll tell you, because it's sort of very easy to explain the essence of the radiation problem, and it's a very important problem. So I thought I can introduce you a new device and explain to you how the physics goes. And then I'll talk a little bit about flash memories. Now, these two devices have something in common. These two devices rely on stored charge for memory. You put some charges in, and then you turn off the transistor or you go away, and then those charges essentially, like flash memory, the charges hold the state 0 or 1, depends on the charge. This is different from an SRAM memory or from a logic circuit, which relies on the voltage source to keep the memory state. If you turn it off, then it will go away. That will be in the next lecture on radiation physics. I'll talk about it. A little bit on hard error, and then we conclude. Now, memory, this is an old slide. Memory, as you know, is a very big thing. Everything uses memory these days, starting from your cell phone to all the computers, and everything uses memory. There are different kinds of memory. Very fast memory are all SRAMs, right? Very easy to access. But for many cases, you would use, for more compact memory design, you would use dynamic random access memory, DRAM. And then this is an old slide, you can see, but you can also see that how the data rates are increasing, how the sizes of the memory are increasing. That is on the right-hand y-axis and as a function of time. And I'll not be surprised if the dotted line that you see on the yellow curve is actually accelerated, because these days, of course, there are lots of innovation in the memory technology. And correspondingly, on the left-hand side, you have the data retention rate in milliseconds. So these days, as the quality of the material is going up, then the recombination time when the charge go away, I'll explain where that comes from in a second. But this red line essentially tells you that how long the state can be there without being replenished. And these days, as the materials are getting better, your data retention time is improving. So you can see even a couple of 100 milliseconds retention time. It depends on the quality of the material. If you had poor quality material and a larger area, of course, you lose a lot of charge quickly, right? And things are getting better in that regard. Bottom line, DRAM is a big business and a lot of interesting application, except that there's one problem. So, but to understand that problem, we just quickly review how a DRAM works. The DRAM is essentially, it's a memory, which is basically this capacitor. A capacitor, as you know, you can put some charge, then it will have some voltage. If you remove that charge, then the voltage is gone. So that's the 0 and 1. So this capacitor that you see on the bottom can essentially be charged or discharged by this pass transistor. And the pass transistor is selected by the word line and bit line. The idea is that there is this big XY grid, which in individual pixels you can access by the word and bit line, and the pass transistor acts like a register to charge up this capacitor. And so how does it work? So if you want to store a 1, then you will put a VDD on the bit line, and then you will turn on the pass transistor by simply raising the voltage greater than the threshold voltage, and the transistor is on, the NMOS transistor is on, and therefore the voltage will VDD will essentially close to VDD will essentially come to the capacitor, and that will store the charge. So that's your level one. And again, if you wanted to discharge the capacitor, then you connect it up, but then make sure that the bit line is grounded. If the bit line is grounded, the charge will flow out. So this is your 0 and 1 for this capacitor. But you can immediately see there is a problem in this type of capacitors. The problem is the following, that what is capacitor's formula? You remember? Epsilon naught A over D, right? And the D is the thickness, dielectric thickness, and A is the area. Now, as you are making the area smaller and smaller and smaller for each technology node, you can see the capacitance will become smaller and smaller. And therefore, the voltage is essentially amount of charge that you can store depends on the capacitance. So as the capacitor is becoming smaller, then of course there's a big concern, because then you cannot store as much charge. And any charge you put in, that can recombine through Shockley-Reed-Hall recombination also. And once this charge is gone, you are not replenishing it until the next cycle comes about. And so therefore, although you may have written a 1, it may have vanished by the time you come back. So therefore, you want to store more charges. So how do you do that? So the way people do it is that they will try to increase the area by wide variety of methods. For example, look at the very right-hand side, which looks like a set of long sticks put in the ground. But what this really is really a capacitor. So the sides, this is a thin oxide running vertically. So it's like a cylinder. It's a cut across the cylinder. And the oxide, so one plate of the oxide is the field region within this. It's a concentric circle. And the other side is a gate. And the whole region is a capacitor, right? It's a vertical capacitor. So people have that type of technology. And of course, the concern many times is that they can sort of collapse onto each other, and so therefore they would have these rings around them to support them. It's like a bunch of sticks, but you don't want them to collapse next to each other. So you put nitride rings next to each other so that they can stay apart like this, right? And so there are lots of innovation in this technology, but you can see more complex the technology is, it becomes more difficult to actually embed it with logic transistors. Very difficult. So therefore, people came up with a new way of doing things where you throw away the capacitor. See, if you throw away the capacitor, then the capacitor problem is gone. But where are you going to store the charge? So this is where this zero capacitor RAM comes from. On the left-hand plot, what I'm showing you is a drain current and gate voltage in a linear plot. You are used to seeing this in the subthreshold in a log plot, but this is a linear plot. And in the neutral state, when you have not put any charge, of course there is some intrinsic charge in the system, right? As is, without putting any extra charge, there is some intrinsic charge. Let's say somehow, if you put extra charges in, then that will shift the threshold voltage, which is on the left, which is on the shown here on the red, on this red field region. How the charge come about, I'll explain in a second. But if you had some charge, like the red charge, then I could call it state one. And if you somehow drained all the black charges from this device, then of course your threshold voltage will also change. It is just like having some fixed charges in the oxide. Remember when you had NBTI, your threshold voltage shifted. And correspondingly here, depending on the charge you put, where you put it, I'm going to explain. But depending on the charge you put, you can distinguish between level 1 and level 0, and therefore it can act as a memory. So this is how it works. In the middle, on the right-hand plot, I'm showing you an SOI transistor. The two oxides is the yellow thing that is on the top and the bottom. WL1 and WL2 are the two sides of the SOI transistor. And then you have the source and drain, which is in BL1 and BL2. Now, this transistor, of course, has how many terminals it has? Essentially, it will have 4 terminals, but there's no ground, and that is the important thing. There's no place for the holes to escape. Remember the hot carrier generation? What happened? Electron hole pair got generated, and then that we used the substrate current as a thermometer. You remember that, right? So here, what we'll do, we'll not allow the substrate current to escape. That's the idea. And so on the top side, top right hand side, you look at the band diagram. This band diagram looks exactly like a hot carrier degradation problem, except you have applied a large bias on the drain, and in this case, in the middle figure, you will see the BL2 is 1.2 volts, let's say. And then what will happen? There will be an impact ionization, and the holes, the electrons will go out, the red, black electrons will get out, no problem. But the holes that have been generated now will come in and get accumulate in the body of the transistor itself. It cannot get out, although it looks like it has enough energy. In that particular diagram, the plus sign, that symbol that's representing the holes, looks like it could get out through the source. But remember, this is a long enough region that the electron, the hole cannot go out ballistically. It will relax and then get trapped in the potential barrier created by the body. As a result, what's going to happen is shown here on the bottom plot. As you know, that if you have more and more holes, then what happens to the quasi-Fermi level? Gradually, what will happen that the band diagram will gradually split from the Fermi level to account for the fact that you have more holes. So these holes on the bottom picture, I have shown 3 holes which have been trapped. This is the excess charge which I am trying to say on the left-hand side as being level 1. The holes, the excess holes that have been trapped within the body because it cannot escape from the substrate. Now, of course, I haven't drawn any electron. Why not? Because the electrons have all gone out through the source and drain. And the amount of shift is the body potential will be whatever number of delta Q is whatever number of holes we have. And the C body is the body capacitance of a SOI transistor, essentially related to the body thickness of the transistor. Okay, so that's level 1. Yes.
So they are using a floating body effect.
Yes. Exactly. So now you see you don't need an extra capacitor. You don't have to drill vertically. You don't have to do any of one of those funny business. And still, you can have a memory. That's where the zero capacitor comes from, because capacitor was the culprit. How do you hold a zero? So for zeros, you have to drain whatever number of holes you had. Even in equilibrium, let's say you had a certain number of holes, you want to drain the holes. How do you drain it? You see, you have to forward bias. You have to forward bias the source body junction. Now you could say, well, if I forward bias it, wouldn't I inject electrons into the system? Yes, you will. That's true. But the electrons will not stay because there's no potential barrier sort of holding them. But the holes, once they get out, the number of holes within the system will now be smaller. Generally, the holes are replenished by the substrate contact. So the reduction of holes is never seen. It is like a base contact. It is like a base contact of a bipolar transistor, right? That if you have the base current coming in, generally it gets out through the emitter. But now you don't have a base contact, floating base contact. And so now what's going to happen? The number of holes will decrease. And as a result, the potential is going to float up, right? Gradually float up. So that eventually it prevents any more holes from leaving this band diagram. So therefore, this is state zero. So this is level 1 and 0 for ZRAM. Now, if you keep a ZRAM as is, then, of course, it's not going to hold it there forever. Why not? Because what's going to happen? Let's say you have written a 0, which means that you have drained all the holes from here. It has very few holes, and the band diagram has moved up in a way so that no electron can come in and no holes can come in. But you see what's going to happen now after a while, is that these holes are going to come back. How? You know, inside under the quasi-Fermi level, you have lots of electrons here, right? In the valence band, lots of electrons. And this is a very high field. The electrons are going to leave. If the electrons is going to leave, means holes are flooding back in. And of course, after a certain period of time, as the field goes down, then, of course, the number of holes that will coming in will be smaller, right? So gradually it will stop. But it will essentially drain the charges. And if you have more defects in the source body or source drain, then that will additionally have the silk component, stress-induced leakage current component, that will further accelerate this charge loss process. So therefore, it's a RAM, dynamic RAM, because the charge that you put in, without refreshing, it doesn't stay there for anymore. Just like a phase change memory is different, right? Once you do it, it stays. But in here, you need to replenish it. So after a certain period of time, as you can see in this sort of up and down charge diagram shown here in the blue dotted line, in the beginning you had 0 holes, very few, and then you have a little bit, and then you have a little bit, so the holes are returning as a function of time. And you can do a simulation like this, time-dependent simulation like this, that will tell you that how long will it be before this hole return. So for example, you can look at it in either ways, top plot, you can look at it as number of holes that you have. So for example, look at state zero, which is blue line. Blue line, in the beginning, how many holes do I have? 0. Blue line is 0 because I have drained everything. But then you can see after about 100 milliseconds or so, 10 to the power minus 1, or about 1 second or within that time, then the blue line is gradually going back to the neutral state. On the other hand, if you had written in 1, right? What is writing 1? Lots of holes you put in. Over time, the holes will drown out because there are excess holes. And the red line, which is shown on the top, it will gradually come back and march to the neutral state. Now, this retention time for this structure is about 1 millisecond. You remember the scaling of retention times going in the first second slide I showed you, gradually going to 500 milliseconds or so. This technology will have about a second before you can refresh. So that's long. The equivalent thing is done in terms of potential. So when you have less number of holes, you have more potential. If you have more electrons, then you have less potential. By the way, what happened up to 1 second? Why doesn't the curve move? It's simply because this is done in a linear plot. If you plot it in the log plot, exponentially you will have seen, just like a subthreshold, exponentially the charge is building up. In a linear plot, you don't see that. So that's why you don't see any movement of the curve before that time. And the difference between these two levels is the noise margin. And you want to retain this noise margin because somehow if the two levels were not separated by much, then you will not be able to distinguish between 0 and 1. Yes?
How do you measure the shift in body potential? Do you look at threshold voltage or something?
Yeah, so this will change the threshold voltage. So what you will do, just like any read, read operation, what you will do is you'll apply a small gate bias and see how much drain current is flowing. And that will, of course, you cannot really read it for too long because any read in DRAM destroys the state. So if you put too much voltage, then all the holes will leave. So you have to apply a small transient voltage just to see how much current flows from that, get the state of the...
The reason that I was asking because there is no direct contact to the body, so somehow we need to...
Just look at the current, the drain current will be sufficient, yes.
The problem with the capacitor was that we couldn't store enough charge.
That's right.
In this method, I don't think we can store much charge compared to...
This is the question is that the two issues. So this question is how much charge can you store in a ZRAM versus DRAM? First of all, let me say that that's for this discussion, radiation discussion, a secondary issue, but I will give you a quick answer. The issue is not so much about how much charge, but at what cost. When you do a deep trench DRAM, you are bringing in a lots of process steps which may not be compatible with the logic that you already put in. So therefore, this is a cost issue. Anytime you do a deep trench, you are doing an ion milling, then filling things up. And then anywhere you have low quality oxide, that may short the transistor. So the question is, yes, you may have a slightly lower charge, but if you save a lot on process integration, that buys you something. Right? But I just want to look at the physics of this and show you how radiation comes in as an introduction to the flash memory discussion. So we'll get there. Because this is exactly like a flash memory, I'll show you. Alright, so how does a soft error, should there be any issue about soft errors? All memory are susceptible to charge injection. For example, so assume that, again, I have replotted the same curve. You see the number of holes, hold time, about a second, things are coming up. That's the blue line on the left. And then I have a certain amount of charge shown here in the body of that, on the right-hand side. Now assume that a strike has come in. What type of strike? It could be an alpha particle, or it could be a proton, or it could be a nuclear bireaction of the neutron. Regardless, let's say a charged particle comes in. What does it do? It generates a lot of electron hole pair, right? But you could say that, well, I have equal number of electron and hole pair, so nothing should be disrupted. But you immediately realize every electron that has been generated, they will go away. But the holes that have been generated will now, of course, will drain anything that you had there. So for example, let me show you, let me see whether I have a picture. So, for example, if you had a large number of holes generated and initially you had state zero, how many holes do you have? Zero, right? Now, let's say you have a strike coming in and you have a large number of holes generated. Electrons are rolling off. I don't care. Holes, on the other hand, the holes that have been generated will now give me a jump. So, if the strike created 0.5 femtocoulomb per micron, generally, a strike generally creates 6 to 10. But let's say it created 0.5 femtocoulomb. Then, this has this amount of charge now, right? If it had 1 femtocoulomb or if it had 1.5 femtocoulomb, then you can see that it is erasing the difference that I originally had. And after a while, I'll not be able to say between 0 and 1. Now, why is it after 0.5 femtocoulomb, why is it flat? Because it's a transient phenomena. Once the strike happens, it deposits a certain amount of charge. Then it goes away. And so therefore, I don't have this continuous accumulation. Whatever I get due to strike, that stays. And then generation recombination then takes care of the rest. So, how do I then, so the threshold LET, what is LET? Linear energy transfer, the maximum amount that you can handle in a technology like this, for this type of technology, is about 1.5 femtocoulomb per micron, right? Now, in order to improve this, what do you have to do? You can increase the stored charge. Then you make the transistor capacitor bigger, or you can essentially make sure that the collection is less. When the strike is happening, collection is less. What can you do to make this thing happen? Do you understand the basic idea? So the basic idea is the following. Let's say take two transistors like this. I have not shown the top and bottom gate, right? In the SOI, I haven't shown that. But other than that, I have shown the source, body, and the drain of two ZRAM, A and B. One is a half the thickness. Which one is better? Now, if you didn't know anything, you would say anything else. You say B might be better. Why? Well, might be because B collects less charge. You know, LET is charge collected per micron. If you have the thickness, it will collect less charge. So that's good. But on the other hand, A could be better also because A has more charge to begin with. So who will win? So the question is, who will win? It turns out that B will win. And the remarkable thing is, B has actually more charge than A, which I couldn't believe in the beginning, but I'd like to convince you that that's really the case. And as you can see, as you decrease the body thickness, it turns out that the amount of charge actually goes up, not down. Why does it happen? And the answer is very simple. If you look at take a cross section along the channel shown here in the blue, which is A, then you will have some source potential, body potential, and the drain potential, you have it. But when your body is thin, you have better electrostatic control. So this is valence band shift. I'm just plotting the valence band. Of course, you have the conduction band. I'm not plotting that. And we are talking about level zero, state zero. This is the red one, is the level for transistor A. You understand, right? Better electrostatic control in a thinner body. Now, you could say the difference between blue and red isn't much. Well, that's not really the case, because you can see this is about maybe 0.2, 0.3 EV. And the number of holes is exponential of 0.3 EV divided by KT. These would have a huge number of holes. So although your body area is factor of 2 smaller, that's true, but this exponential increase because of the better electrostatic control gives you a better charge. So actually, this thinner body will be more resilient. So in the first lecture, in the radiation lectures, I said that the technology for some of them is getting better with scaling in terms of critical charge. This is what I meant, that actually because of this electrostatic effect, you collect less radiation charge and you hold more charges to begin with. Now, of course, you cannot make it to zero. I mean, you have to stop somewhere. But the thing is that generally for typical things, it compensates things well. So let's look at this plot, which sort of summarizes the whole results. You see, I'm plotting the body thickness in x-axis, and how much charge do you need for this incident particle to disrupt the state? That's what I'm plotting in here. Let's start by looking at the red diamonds. So as you can see, that as the body thickness is, let's say, 5 nanometers, in that case, actually things isn't very good. Even with a 1 femtocoulomb, you're dead, right? That's the simulation I showed, 1.5 femtocoulomb, you are dead. But as your body thickness is gradually going down by about 2 nanometer or so, you have a little bit higher, about 4 femtocoulomb of charges that you need before upset. So you are getting better. And same is true for the green lines, which is for 50 nanometer channel, because if the channel length is longer, you hold more charges. And for the blue square, you see you can get up to even 11 femtocoulomb for 2 nanometer body thickness. Now, whether you can make 2 nanometer reproducibly or not, that's the second question. But at least you immediately realize that generally 6 and up is the threshold, because every alpha particle deposits 6 femtocoulomb per micron. That was my last lecture, right? I explained how to calculate that. And so you can see that if your body thickness is about 5 nanometer or more, then none of these technologies will be radiation hard, because every time a alpha particle cuts it, it will flip a bit. Only on the ones on the left-hand side, above the 6 femtocoulomb threshold, those will survive. Those will be fine. And then you can essentially show that how the body thickness and the channel length should be scaled in order that you make a good Z-RAM. All right. So this is something, a calculation you can do, and then see whether what type of Z-RAM would be insensitive to alpha particle strikes. Yes.
Can you reach that in one less than 5?
Okay. So the question is whether we can reach this 5 nanometers. So last week I was in a reliability conference, international reliability physics conference, and Tianming Hu, who invented FinFET, I mean, among others, so he had to answer this question. People were asking that, can you do multiple threshold, because FinFET body is often undoped. He said that if there is money to be made here, and if the industry remains as big as it is, people will make anything that you can think of. Even when I was in Bell Labs 15 years ago, people would laugh that anybody will be able to make oxide less than 7 nanometer, because they used to say there's fundamental limit of the filamentation when you do deposition. These days you have 1 nanometer and you don't think about it. So therefore, don't ask any question on practical aspect of it. If it makes money, it will be done. Money is a great driver. Alright, so this is about ZRAM. Now, I want to explain to you, ZRAM is a small business, few companies like Samsung and Hyundai and, not Hyundai, what is that company? Hendrix. So in Korea, many, many companies, Micron, they have been working on this. So this is an interesting technology. But I wanted to use it as a segue to a more important technology, which is flash memory. Everybody has flash memory, right? And the idea in flash memory is something like this. You have a transistor on the left-hand plot, on this vertical, you have a transistor, N+, N+, NP, this is NMOS transistor. But the interesting thing is that this transistor doesn't have a normal gate, like what we typically have. It has one gate on one oxide, but then it has floating gate, the FG. Typically, this would have been the normal gate. And then it has another oxide, and then it has a control gate. Now, for a second, can I ask you to forget about the transistor, just for a second, and just focus on this floating gate as being the middle point, the two oxides as being the two oxides of the ZRAM. ZRAM had top and bottom oxide, you remember? So therefore, just if you forgot about that transistor for a second, you would start immediately see that this is a ZRAM in disguise. Now, this is when there's no charge. So if you don't have any charge, then it has certain threshold voltage, whatever you designed it with for that word thickness. Then, if you want to write a 1, what would you do? You'd inject charge into the floating gate, floating body, just like you injected charge in the ZRAM. You did it by impact ionization in ZRAM. How would you do it here? You'd essentially apply a very large voltage, 12 volts, on the gate. And when you apply a gate voltage, then essentially charges will be injected, tunneled through and into the floating gate. And then you have that charge, which will be called a 1. And then if you drain the charge, you will have a 0. And that figure on the top essentially tells you that depending on which transistor you write or which memory element you write, you may have 1 or 0, right? And these days, this is the big thing, right? Very high density memories, you do it this way. What is the problem? Normal thing run at 1 volt or so, right? Logic. What voltage do you need for this one? 12 volts or so. So you need an internal charge pump in order to, not charge pumping, a charge pump in order to boost the voltage. And this is very difficult. And that's why you cannot scale the oxide, because if you make it smaller, thinner, what will happen? Any electron that you have put in will drain out. And you cannot have more than 1 electron draining out in 10 years. That's the bottom line of the design criteria. And so therefore, this is, you have to keep the bottom oxide thick. All right. But let's talk about radiation. The radiation is shown here on the right-hand side. What does it do to flash memory? Now, you already know the answer. So therefore, you can see just it will do whatever the ZRAM did, it will do the same thing here. But slightly different, however, I want to explain that. By the way, so some of the work that we did a couple of years ago, many groups in Europe have taken it up. So for example, you can see the cross section that I have. Do you see the green floating gate? That is where the charges will be stored. And do you see the control gate? That's where the 12 volt will be applied. And the ONO and TO, these are thermal oxide and oxynitride oxide. So therefore, those will be the barriers where it will prevent the trapped electrons in the system. And then you have systems like this. You'll put many of the transistors. Then you put them in the board. And then you go to the mountains. Or you go to the nuclear sources, like nuclear, the radiators. Or you put it up in the balloon and to get excess radiation, remember? And so you do the test, and after 12 months, then generally you get a test. So initially, let's say you had some, the blue curve was original threshold voltage distribution. You wanted that everybody who is at zero, state zero, they have this one. So let's say you write zero for all the cells and then float it up in the balloon. Then 12 months later, or you use it some radiation sources, you look at the threshold. Now, these red points are the threshold after 12 months, and you can see that these are all gone, right? These are all gone because this was originally written as zero. Now it has moved to one. And so these are all gone because of the radiation error. So how did that happen? Why is it gone? So there are many ways it could happen. On the top left, for example, do you remember stress-induced leakage current? So if you had defects, then that will drain charges. And if you drain charges, then the state may be lost. On the bottom left-hand side, this could be the just like the ZRAM. Remember, if you left the ZRAM, electron and hole used to tunnel in, and after a while, the charge was lost. And it's the same could happen here also. That is the bottom left. And this is a transient conducting pipe. If you have a strike, initially it generates a lot of electron hole pairs. So some people have postulated a conducting pipe. But I want to tell you something much simpler. It's like dropping sugar in a coffee, and then if you are not careful, this is the physics of the very last one. Because one thing you realize immediately, right? If you have a strike, if you have exactly the same number of electrons and holes generated, then it should not matter at all. Because the same number of, unlike the ZRAM case, ZRAM, the electrons could easily escape. Here, if you have 25 electrons generated and 25 holes generated, then it doesn't matter. Because the total number, even after all the recombinations going on, if the initial number was 100, so you went to 125 and 25. After recombination, you still have 100. Nothing should have happened if there is no spillover. You know, the problem will occur if you drop that sugar cube in the coffee and the coffee spills over. Then there is a problem. Otherwise, there is no problem in this scenario because it will all disappear. So this is a picture of the band diagram. So what happens that this is the floating gate. Why is the band not all aligned? Because you have stored charges here. Therefore, the bands are not all aligned. And then, of course, over time, you have more electrons here, let's say. And then over time, the electrons and holes will generally go. But when you have a radiation strike, what's going to happen? That the electrons will get out through here faster compared to the holes. Because the electrons can go over, just like in that case, similar to the ZRAM, because now you have a lot of energy. And as they go out, the charge state will be lost because you will not have as many electrons as you had before. So I want to tell you how to do these calculations correctly. All companies these days, every big company, have radiation simulator running in their companies, because this is one of the most important reliability mechanisms. So you do something like this. So in old days, of course, when the oxide was very thick, these holes couldn't go out very quickly. Then there'd be one problem, that once the holes come in, this is taken from a 606 book, if you remember, bias temperature instability, in old days, that holes would get trapped and therefore change the threshold voltage. So it used to cause one type of problem. These days, the oxides are much thinner on the right-hand side, you see, and so nothing gets really trapped. Very few gets trapped. Most of them, nothing, at least not enough to change the electrostatics, right? But what happens, the electron hole gets out of that box, and that causes the memory loss. All right, so you can do a calculation, and the calculation involves three stages. One stage is called the energy dynamics. How much energy you have put in? Where is this energy coming from? Alpha particle brought in how many? 5 to 10 MeV, mega electron volts, right? It brought in, and once it strike this place, it made the whole thing very hot. And when it became hot, what does it do? It essentially makes the tail of the distribution, Fermi distribution, longer. Of course, it made tail of the Fermi distribution hotter everywhere. In the control gate, in the substrate, in the tunnel, everywhere. Everywhere things got hot. However, the ones in the middle, there were more of them in terms of numbers. So this flux getting out will be more. All are hot, but will be more compared to the flux that is coming in. So the first step is to say, how hot did they get? And one of the most commercial simulator, not commercial, I mean, this is from Stanford Linear Accelerator. They had been maintaining this open source code that everybody uses, just like Medici, just like COMSOL. It is called GN4. Yeah, there's 4 or 5, whatever the version is. And anytime you want to do MeV type Monte Carlo simulation, very high energy necessary for atomic reactions, then you use GN4. If you want to do Monte Carlo below 10 MeV, what simulator should you be using? At Purdue, we have one, right?
NEMO.
NEMO, sir. We should use one, we have Demons, and what is the other one? The Bell Labs one? What was it called? I'm trying to remember. Remember, I mentioned a few softwares. It will come to me. All right. But those you can only do below 10 MeV. If you want to do higher, then you have to use GN4. And once you have done the energy, then you do the transport. And once you have done the transport, then you self-consistently solve for electrostatics. As the charges are leaving, the whole band diagram will be floating down. So this is how it looks. In the last class, I told you about this Bethe formula. What was the Bethe formula all about? Bethe formula was amount of energy loss per unit distance. You remember that, right? And I said that you do an integration and you get a little formula for the Bethe formula. But inside Bethe formula, this is what is happening. So when a strike comes through, then remember, it is sort of interacting with all the electrons within that lattice. And I drew a cartoon last time. But really what happens is, as a strike coming through, then it generates a huge number of electron hole pairs, which are very large energy. And these will essentially spill over, right? And on the top right-hand side, you see essentially a cartoon picture of how the electrons are sort of getting ejected because of the large energetic particles. So you just set it up. You set the material, you tell it is silicon 28 or boron 10, whatever, you made the materials, you do the simulation, it will automatically generate all the electron hole pairs with full electromagnetic interaction and tell you how hot the carriers are going to be. Now you see, there is this particle is 177 MeV chlorine. Why chlorine? We didn't talk about chlorine, right? What did you talk about? Alpha particles, protons, neutrons. Where did chlorine come from? Chlorine is used as an accelerator. Accelerator meaning, remember that in order to do a voltage acceleration, what did you do? We cannot test it at 1 volt. So we tested at 2 volts, we tested at 3 volts, and then extrapolated. Similarly, you cannot wait for a proton to come in. And generating high fluxes of proton is difficult. So therefore, what you do, it's a poor man's proton. So you put 177 MeV chlorine, see how many particles are generated, then extrapolate it down to see how many what would have a proton done if the proton were used by using theoretical extrapolation. So this, look how this relaxation goes. So for example, I'm on the top side, I'm showing you the flux that is leaving the substrate. So do you see the band diagram, the oxide band diagram? I have not shown the valence band side. I'm just showing you the conduction band side and rotated 90 degrees. And the arrow, the blue arrow, essentially telling how the fluxes go. And the four plots you see is sort of the electron distributions. You can see after 3 femtosecond, femto is 10 to the power minus 15 seconds, right? Within 3 femtoseconds, everything, all the electron holes, essentially they have thermalized by, so they generated a lot of charges, essentially thermalized, and the temperature has become larger than the temperature of the sun at this point, temporarily at that point. And that's the blue line. You can see a long blue tail and essentially telling you how hot the carriers are. And every particle which is above the conduction band on the red on the top, which is about here, how much is it for silicon conduction band? Do you remember? 3.1 eV, right? Silicon conduction band. So everybody who is above 3.1 eV has a pass put to leave. All the electrons can leave if you have 3.1 eV or more. Within 10 femtoseconds, you see very strange things are happening. First of all, you see a bunch of oscillations on the top side about 3.1 eV. Where are these oscillations coming from? This is because when the quantum mechanical tunneling is happening, the oxide essentially will have the oscillation associated with it. So these are the oscillations associated with it. And then, of course, there is also the optical phonon relaxation. So that will give you some oscillations also. And do you see, within 300 femtosecond is 0.3 picosecond. Your clock is at a gigahertz, a nanosecond. So these are all happening in a fraction and fraction of the clock. Everything is gradually relaxing back. Your energy is getting below 3.1 eV. Nothing will get out. So all the physics of this charge loss will happen within 100 femtoseconds or so. Everything will be lost. And if you are not dead that by that time, whatever your state you have. So the ever energy loss is shown here on the right. And you can see that as the energy is getting relaxed, a fraction of them are happening due to the phonons as things are cooling down. But that does not lead to any charge loss, right? This is sort of there was a big excitation and gradually it relaxes down. So therefore no loss in the charge state. The problem is this blue line, which is the loss due to emission. The loss because they left and therefore you have less charge. And you really understand now, right, why the blue line has saturated. Because after 100 femtoseconds, the energy was below 3.1 eV and therefore it really would not go anywhere. So you can do again this type of calculations for a wide variety of sources. Let me start with the figure on the right hand side. On the right hand side, the x-axis is called the particle LET. What is LET? LET is the amount of charge deposited. And do you remember in the last class I said that how much energy generally a neutron brings in, a proton brings in, how much an alpha particle brings in? This would be shown here on the two leftmost one, the black point, that is how much charge this particle LET has. And then the red one says how much charge this brings in. As a result, the y-axis essentially is saying how much charge will be lost. So you have to read on the right-hand side of the plot. So tell me how much charge will be lost due to this black alpha particle. About 500. Look at the right-hand side, about 500. How many of this? About 750 on the right-hand side. Okay, so now look at the left-hand side. As the memory, flash memory is getting smaller and smaller, it's holding smaller and smaller amount of charge. So if you started with 90 nanometer technology, now let's say you are 50 nanometer or smaller technology, then the area is becoming smaller, so the amount of stored charge is becoming smaller and smaller. That's shown here in the red blue curve on the top. That's the amount of stored charges. So how many stored charges do you have at 40 nanometer technology? The whole thing has 100 electrons sitting here, storing your whatever music or other things that you're putting in. It has about 100 electrons doing the job. Now let's say you can only stand 5%. Then that will be this magenta diamonds. And or you can withstand 20% charge loss. Then that will be the green one. So take any one of them. Now you remember that with the alpha particle, which is this horizontal line, how many did you lose? Is close to maybe close to 100, let's say. And for the other one, maybe a couple of 100, the red horizontal line. Now do you see immediately which technology would be very difficult to sustain in terms of scaling? If your system cannot stand more than 5% loss, then you cannot read it, let's say, your flash memory, you cannot read it. Then you cannot scale flash memory below 70 nanometer, because every time a particle will come in, alpha particle will come in, it will cause you an upset because the electrons have left. On the other hand, let's say your design is very sophisticated, your read circuitry have been very carefully done, then you may be able to move with the green line, because green line is, it can withstand a little bit more. But you cannot go beyond 50 if you had an alpha particle. And with a neutron strike, neutron generates a bunch of alpha particle, you remember. And with a neutron strike, you cannot go beyond 70 nanometer. This is the challenge of flash memory design and radiation hardening of it. Because whatever charge you have, that's the charge you have, right? And once you have a strike, then you have to sort of leave with this reduced charges and see whether you can read the reduced charges or not. So these are, for example, from simulations, how people show, and there are corresponding experiments that show how for every strike, there can be a charge loss associated with it. So I have one slide for this, and then we'll be done. So remember, these are hot electrons, right? Hot electrons leaving the stored charge. Now, do you remember another place where we talked about hot electrons? Hot electron degradation, right? Do you remember what happened in that case? What happened? The electron went out, hot electrons, the hot well went out, they recombined and that caused degradation. Why wouldn't it happen here? Hot electrons getting out, what electrons getting out through the oxides, hot holes are getting out through the oxides. So a fraction of them, which are captured, will again give rise to electron degradation, and this will create bulk defects. And if you have the bulk defects, once again, you can do the relaxation processes. You look at 500 femtoseconds, essentially everything has cooled down just like before. The plot on the left-hand side, the red points, just like the hot carrier degradation, you can see how things are depending on different hot carrier degradation. It was voltages, right? Different voltages made it hot. Here, it is the time, as a function of time, things are getting cooler. And as a result, what you can do is you can calculate as a function of dose, how many particles you have striking this, number of oxide traps. Do you remember that universal scaling laws, right? Remember, you can scale different voltages. Here, there's no voltage per se, but as a function of dose, you can calculate how many defects you'd be generating. And similarly, this cuts out. It is called not a silk. What should you call this? Let's see whether you can guess. This is not a silk. Silk was stress-induced leakage current. There's nothing,
Radiation-induced leakage
current. Right. So this is called a RILK. RILK is radiation-induced leakage current, because as a result, what will happen, that you'll have defects. And remember that all these charges have to be trapped inside this for 10 years. Now, if you have one of them, a little hole there in your bucket, then of course, sooner or later, one of the electrons will escape through that defect, and then you are gone. That memory cell is gone. Not really. I mean, there are all sorts of error correction codes, but zeroth order. All right. So let me conclude then. This is a sort of I told you a little bit about memory. Two types of memory, right? Charge-based memory, where you temporarily put the charge, and then essentially you go away. Now, ZRAM is not a temporary memory. You need to refresh. But the reason I bought in, and ZRAM is still not a technologically viable. It's not. There are companies and lots of work, but it's still not a big memory technology. But I bought it in just to explain to you the flash memory, because it, then it becomes obvious how to think about it. And you understand that this is permanent memory, so it will be susceptible to radiation damage. Now, people say that it could be a successor to DRAM for ZRAM, but I'm not 100% sure, and especially because it has a significant radiation-related concern. Now, what I said that flash memory doesn't have a classical soft error. What is a classical soft error? Do you remember? How does a junction gets into error? Or how does the intrinsic device get into error? Do you remember? What was it?
Lot of generation in the junction.
No, that is true. You have a lot of generation that could temporarily change the electrostatics. But there is another concern for the intrinsic one. What was the concern?
Mobility.
The mobility was different. Electron hole mobility are different. Now here the electrons are not going anywhere. If the electron, no. What I should say, if the electron did not leave, then the mobility difference wouldn't make many difference. If you had some extra generated, so what? They would have recombined and everything would be good. So you don't have the, and nobody is leaving. Like in a junction, the electron holes leave. So nobody is leaving in this particular case. If that happened, then that would be classical. But in this particular case, you have a new kind of soft error because the stored charge has now been lost. Now, if you have soft error, okay, if you had a problem with your, then you have a problem with your PowerPoint slide, right? If you have a soft error when you're flying to your conference in California, you had some radiation error, so you had one bit which flipped incorrectly, you have a problem in the PowerPoint slide, it doesn't open, okay? That's not a problem, you can rewrite it, in principle. But if you have a hard error, then there's no other way but to remap the whole thing, remap a section of the thing. And that's a big reliability problem because then you need additional algorithm, additional things, additional memory you have to put in, and that's a big concern, right? Okay. So there are lots of good papers on this topic. We have worked on this for a couple of years, so but in terms of GN4 is a very good tool. This one, ACMM2, this is from IBM, is again a very good tool. People are always afraid of using these tools because they don't know the physics, they haven't learned in school. But once you know the basic physics, this is no more difficult than where if Professor Lundstrom teaches, for example, ballistic transport and scattering. Physics is very simple, there's nothing to it. So once you know the physics, actually doing these things are not that bad. Many times people will be using Medici and other simulators where they will not account for the electron hole, the energy of the electrons. But if the number is the main thing that is causing the problem, if the Poisson equation is the main thing, then you can simply use a drift diffusion solver, like an junction upset and all, you can do it. For flash memory or other things where hot carrier is important and fundamental, you have to use Monte Carlo so that you can see how many charges can go over that barrier. All right, so that's it.